702.
The Naked Scientist.
Time for The Naked Scientist with Dr. Chris Smith. How are you doing?
Happy Monday. I'm feeling really good. I had a nice little holiday. I went to Cornwall in the southwest of England and went on lots of long walks and ate lots of Cornish pasties. So I'm both well fed and energised and re-energised to come and talk to you. So I'm very pleased to be here today.
There we go. Let's get started. Kim asks the question, is salt affecting our bodies more negatively than before?
Well, salt, I presume we're referring to table salt, is sodium chloride. And there are many, many studies that have shown that salt is an essential part of our body and we need to have a certain amount of salt coming in. But the majority of us have far too much salt in our diet. You need a very small amount to be healthy, just a gram or so a day. Most of us are eating six times that amount in a day. Why does it matter? Because salt has a really powerful effect on blood pressure. And over a lifetime, the longer your exposure to salt at high level, the greater your blood pressure tends to be. So it has a blood pressure elevating effect across age and across world populations. There was a really big study called the InterSalt study, where they compared people who do and don't add supplemental salt in their diet and found a really clear association between the amount of salt people eat and how high their blood pressure becomes. And blood pressure is a big risk factor for heart disease, probably the biggest risk factor for heart disease and stroke and kidney problems and eye problems and so on. So having lower levels of salt, and certainly not in excess of what we need, is the healthiest way to go. And we don't believe that has changed anytime soon. But we as a nation, as a world nation, are eating more salt on average. Foods have tended to change to become saltier. Why? Because it tends to taste good and we like eating stuff and we're eating more snacky type foods, fast foods and so on, very high in salt. And often that salt is covert. We don't know it's there. We just know the food tastes good. And so we're getting a big amount of salt in our diet and people regard this as quite a risk factor. So if you can, try and cut down the amount of salt in your diet, you will reduce your risk of getting high blood pressure.
All right. Then we've got another question that has come through. It says, can you please ask Dr. Chris Smith if a person can die as a result of a broken heart?
Well, this perennially comes up usually around Valentine's Day because people don't often get the sort of romantic nod that they were hoping to get. But the answer is yes, there is evidence for this, both metaphorically but also physically in reality. And not just humans, animals can succumb to this as well. Some animals form really strong bonds to their partner, lifelong monogamous bonds. And when they lose a partner, a life partner, then it can send them into a terminal health decline. In humans, there is evidence that people do show very, very depressed mood when they lose someone close to them or if they separate from someone very close to them. We know that depression, loneliness and mental ill health are really big risk factors for all diseases of all persuasions, and not just people taking their own life, but that's an important consideration too. But all kinds of diseases get worse and occur at a younger age and progress more rapidly if you have mental ill health on board. And being unpartnered, unpaired when you had been, you've lost someone and so on, this is one way that that happens. So yes, I think there's actually quite good evidence that being with someone makes us happier and healthier. And the biggest beneficiaries epidemiologically appear to be men. If you look at people who are as a couple, men do much better out of getting married than if they stay single. And they tend to be healthier for longer and have fewer ill health complaints at a younger age. Women don't do badly out of getting married, but they don't do as well through being in a partnership as men do. So men benefit enormously through coupling up and being with someone. Women slightly less so, but both suffer mental problems and health problems in the aftermath of losing someone close to them.
All right. Another question that is coming through on 0727021702 is a voice note.
Hey, really, Will. Man, what are we doing, man? When she says that you look beautiful, I'm visually impaired, but I could see you. Your Thabo, don't do that. Yeah, cheers, man. Good afternoon.
Dr. Chris Smith, maybe help us understand, when a person is visually impaired or blind and they still can say things like you are beautiful or I can imagine, what is the reference point? And I know we've touched on this before, I think when we spoke about what can blind people see. But what is the reference point when a person is visually impaired or blind says that?
It really matters if someone has seen before or never seen. A good friend of mine, I've lost him now, unfortunately, when I was growing up, had been blind almost from birth. So he had no visual memories. But he had lots of friends in the blind community that went blind later in life. And he said to me, the most poignant thing he said was they love going to sleep because they can see again. And what he was getting at is that when you go to sleep and you dream, then all of those visual areas in your brain that were decoding what was coming into your eyes when you could see, they reanimate. And so you can remind yourself what colours look like, what faces look like, and so on. If you have seen in the past, you have that mental framework and you can use your imagination to summon up what things looked like. But if you've lived in an unseeing world your entire life, you never built that framework, you never built those references, but you appraise and assess the world in quite a different way, and other senses can become much reinforced. And I never forget, I watched a blind person walk into a room and tell me, almost as accurately as if I had a tape measure, where the walls were, where the windows were, where the doorways were. And they were just tuned in to how the sound was going around this room. And they could work out very instinctively, without even giving it much thought, apparently, the anatomy of that room, because they had tuned their other senses in so well to hearing, to the sense of air moving past them, the temperature changes and so on. And we become much more focused. Our brains, as a seeing person, your brain, about a third of it is decoding what you're seeing. It's a huge amount of neurological territory that is vacated if you don't see. And so you can change its allegiance to do other jobs. And people have done a lot of studies on this. Now we have really good brain scanning techniques where you can do what's called functional imaging. You can put people in brain scanners and you can ask them to think about certain things, and you can see which bits of the brain change their activity. And also, when you send one kind of stimulus, you can see which bits of the brain respond to those stimuli. So which bits of the brain are connected to each other. And you can see quite different patterns of wiring and neurological recruitment in the brains of people who have never seen, arguing that that vacant territory that would normally be devoted to exploring and decoding the visual world is lending support to other senses, reinforcing them, which is why blind people can pick up a page of Braille, run their fingertips over them at lightning speed, as it would be to me, and just read off what it says on the page. And you think, my goodness, how on earth do they do that? But that's because they are the blind equivalent of, in the same way my dog can lift his nose in the air and see with smell, your other senses reinforce the missing one. And you're able to really experience the world in a far richer way in your other senses than a person would who can see, probably for that reason. So it would depend, when they're trying to envisage the gorgeous Relebonkere in their mind, have they seen you in the past, or have they seen someone like you, or are they using other cues like the richness of your voice, your laughter, your humour, the warmth that comes across on the radio, regardless of whether you can see someone or not. And those things build a different kind of picture in your mind depending upon what your reference point is.
Thank you so much for that one. Let's go to Joe from Benoni. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, Dr. Chris and the crew.
Yes.
I've got a problem with my son. He tripped and fell on his arm. And it looks like he's got a fracture or a dislocation. It was at the end of June, by the 30th of June. But now he visited the hospital about twice. And then they said it's not okay. How long, Dr. Chris, do you think it's going to take if ever there's a fracture or there's a dislocation? He is 26 years old.
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry, Joe, to hear that. Which bit of his arm has he hurt? His wrist you're talking about, or is it another part of him?
It's a small finger and the second one.
Right, okay. Well, fingers, you don't normally get dislocations in fingers, but fingers are quite hard to break, but not impossible. What he really needs is an X-ray.
It looks like it's a fracture.
Yeah, he needs an X-ray, because has it been properly X-rayed so someone can actually see what's going on inside?
They said it's a fracture, but now my problem, I want to know how long is it going to take, because now
I get that, Joe, but what I'm asking is, has someone X-rayed his hand?
Yes.
Okay, and could they see a fracture there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, the key thing with fingers, fingers are usually a bit more forgiving than other bones in the body when you fracture them, because they can be supported. If you've got the two fingers, and you, normally what you do is you strap the two fingers or the three fingers together, and then each finger acts as its neighbour's splint and holds it nice and straight. As long as the bones aren't displaced all over the place, they should knit together and there shouldn't be loss of function, as long as it hasn't involved the joint. If it's got into the joint and fractured or damaged that, there's a higher risk of things like arthritis and longer term stiffness and deformities and so on. That needs checking to make sure that hasn't happened. But given it was in June and that's 2 months ago, by now the bone should be stitching together quite nicely. But you've got to be a bit careful, because it will take a while before it gets full strength, because the bone has to remodel and rebuild to get full strength over time. But it should now, 2 months later, it should have fixed itself. I hope it hasn't been allowed to remain in a displaced state or with damage to a joint surface, though. But good luck to him.
Thank you so much. Ben in Kensington. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thank you. Doctor, I hope you're having a good day. I started smoking after my divorce. I'm in my 40s. I believe that cocaine is the most addictive substance. Smoking or nicotine and alcohol vie for fourth and fifth place as most addictive substance or practice. Now, I smoke, after 2 years of smoking, guess how many boxes of cigarettes I smoke a year?
How many?
2 to 3 boxes a year. And my question to the doctor is, why am I not addicted?
How big's a box?
Maybe it's a carton.
Matter.
He's talking about those 20 boxes. No, don't name the brand, please.
So basically, I smoke between like 20 and 30 cigarettes a year.
Yes.
And like, why am I not addicted, Doctor? Please pray tell.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is that in order to become addicted to a drug, I mean, as you say, some drugs do produce a very profound chemical effect very quickly. Some, it's a gentler, slippery slope, but all end up in the same place, which is they rewire your brain, and specifically they rewire the reward system in your brain, which they hijack so that you basically trigger a massive reward response every time you get the drug. And when you don't have the drug, then the reward system becomes underoccupied and becomes agitated. And your reward system is what drives you to be motivated to do anything. When you're hungry, your reward system, when you think about food, has a little flurry of activity, and that makes you think, I need to eat. And when you eat, you get a big burst of activity, and that rewards you for having eaten and reinforces the behaviour. So when you take a drug, you think about taking the drug, you get a little flurry of dopamine in your reward system that makes you think about taking the drug more. When you take the drug, you get a big burst of that activity and it reinforces it. So it's basically food on steroids, neurologically speaking. Now, if you don't do this very often, if you do this just here and there, you don't have a chance to rewire the brain in the way that will lead to that entrenched behaviour. It does take a while to get addicted to something. For instance, we give morphine to patients in hospital who are in extreme pain, for example, or we give morphine-like drugs. They don't become dependent on morphine and opioid-like agents immediately. We use those drugs because, given sensibly and safely, they're very powerful and they're very useful. If we kept on giving that patient that agent, quite quickly they would become dependent. So it's about the amount of the frequency and the regularity with which the drug taking occurs that can lead to this rewiring of your reward system. So I would put it to you, and I wouldn't challenge you to change the status quo. Smoking is the worst thing you can do for your health, to be perfectly honest, and you're much better off not doing it, because it's linked to every disease known to man, honestly. So really, if you were to do it more and you did it more regularly, and you often it's wired up into social circumstances as well. People find they do it more in social settings, and before they know it, because they're socializing and having cigarettes, as a result, they tend to link the two things, and you do it more, which rewires your brain. You aren't doing it enough, presumably, in order to get hooked on it, because it's not just doing it a bit that then hooks you. It is the behavioural thing that means you do it frequently enough to cause that rewiring effect that then produces the unpleasant sensation when you don't have the drug and the reward sensation when you do, which is what is then the physical addiction.
Thank you so much for that question. The last one comes through from Trainin Pretoria, who says, if I stop drinking and smoking, will my shaking stop?
Oh dear. Well, look, I'm really sorry to hear you've got
so many questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that you've got some shaking. Smoking doesn't generally cause people to shake. Shaking can occur for a number of reasons. It can occur because of anxiety, it can occur because of neurological problems, and it can occur for benign reasons. There's something called benign essential tremor, and people have this from birth. It runs in families, and you just get a bit of a shake or tremor in your hands, which as you go to do something normally goes away. But withdrawal from alcohol can cause shakiness, and that is actually called DTs or delirium tremens for that particular reason. And you must be very careful if you've been a heavy drinker about stopping drinking abruptly, because no drug, if you stop it abruptly, kills anybody with the exception of alcohol. And abrupt cessation of alcohol can be life-threatening. So be very, very careful if you have been drinking heavily and you do occasionally get the shakes, or when you don't have a drink, you find you get shaky. This may indicate dependency, and that may mean you're at risk, because what can happen is alcohol mimics and strengthens the inhibitory nerve transmitter pathways in the brain. And this means that if you don't have alcohol on board, those inhibitory systems are running a lower level of activity than they should be, which means you're at higher risk of developing things like fitting. And that can be life-threatening. So that's why when we have a patient who's been a heavy drinker, we manage their withdrawal very carefully. So if you are in that position, A, I'm very sorry to hear that. B, I would strongly recommend getting some professional help to slowly wean off the alcohol to avoid those problems, and also look at your diet to make sure that you're not at risk from being deficient in some of the key vitamins the brain needs, because that can be a problem as well.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Chris Smith. Back next week.